all the life. There were plants and birds and rocks and things. There was sand and hills and rain. The first thing I met was a fly with a buzz and the sky with no clouds. The heat was hot and the ground was dry, but the air was full of sound. I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain. In the desert, you can remember your name, 'cause there ain't no one for to give you no pain.
Talk with George Norrie. Call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And this is our final hour now with our guest, John Taylor Gatto. We'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We'll take your phone calls this hour with our guest, John Taylor Gatto. John, before we get to the calls, give me your views on homeschooling. I wasn't really aware of it, except for a few years ago when people would call my program in St. Louis talking about how much they enjoyed homeschooling their kids. And I kept saying, what's that? But apparently they can do it. It's legal, right?
I'm overwhelmed with admiration, and it's not from a few contacts. I've done the keynote speech for 38 state homeschool conventions, some of them religious, some of them quite secular, and I am impressed beyond my power to communicate with the strength of the families that that undertaking provides, and also with the tremendous progress in intellectual and character development that's possible because you're freed from the strictures of systematic schooling. I'm going to be speaking for a homeschooling group in Spain in January, and I'm anxious to see the way they do it.
So you agree with it, though? You like it?
At first, it was a word to me. And most of the New York crowd would say, who would want to spend that much time with their kids? But it turns out to be just a dynamic and electric experience. Yeah, I'm in awe of what I've seen.
It is, I guess, legal to homeschool in most states, if not all states.
In every state.
Okay.
And if the local, this will be useful to your audience, if the local school district, as some do, gives you some trouble, you want to be a member of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. It doesn't cost much. I think it's $100 a year, and I don't work for them, so this is an unpaid testimonial. But let me tell you, I've never met a school superintendent who wants to tackle those people. So they run good interference for you.
Who does the homeschooling primarily, the mother or the father?
Well, I would say the 25% of it. Now, this took me a long time to figure out. In 25% of the homeschooling families, both the mother and the father are working. So in the nature of an education, the kid has to do 90% of the work anyway. One of the things that are wrong with for schooling is we've reversed that formula, and 90% is done by the authority. Doesn't work for education. It's the grappling. So in 25% of the cases, apparently there are arrangements made with neighbors, with businesses, with uncles and aunts. And the other 75%, I would say, in most cases, it's the mother, although I've certainly met a sprinkling of fathers who, because of death or other reasons, do it. By and large, there's this experimental consciousness in homeschoolers.
Do some families bring in, let's say, a music teacher? When either one doesn't understand? Okay, sure, that's interesting.
They can draw on the entire community. And something to encourage your audience ought to be this. The most prestigious scientific job in the world, nothing's even close, is the head of the Human Genome Project, who happens to be a homeschooler. And get ready for this shock. Although he was raised in a non-religious household in Western Virginia, when he got to Harvard as a homeschooler, he decided to become a born-again Christian. He said the decision was, I'm quoting directly from the New York Times, intellectually inescapable, close quote. Now, I can tell you his colleagues are a little bit nervous about that, but look at that. This guy's raised on a remote sheep ranch in Western Virginia, and the curriculum he used was as follows. I would say 10% of the nation's homeschoolers use this curriculum. He studied whatever he felt like studying for as long as he felt like studying it, and then he changed to something different. There was never any attempt to have a balance, you know, two from column A and one from column B, and here's social studies. His name's Francis S. Collins, Collins, and he's the head of the Human Genome Project. So
that's remarkable.
It really is remarkable. I would hate in 20 years to have my kids, who both were National Merit Scholars, I would hate to have them in competition with this huge cohort of homeschooled kids that are now passing through that non-systematic system.
To the phones we go. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, sir.
I'm in the Chicago area, actually Highland Park, Illinois, Nathaniel. And when it comes to creationism, what I see is that it's a fusion of poor science and a poor understanding of Genesis, poor skills in the Semitic languages, and so on and so forth. Arpel just had on somebody who spoke about, was an expert in Semitic languages. Does that sound right, or was it a rerun?
That was a rerun, I believe, last week.
Yeah. And then you've had on a Stan from his website.
Stan Tenen.
Yeah, right.
Who, by the way, is going to be on again this week.
Pardon me?
He's going to be on again this week, as a matter of fact.
Oh, great. Because both of them are basically on target, but, you know, well, anyway. So that's why I say that a lot of people can get a little off when it comes to Genesis. And how creationism is a fusion is, you know, they take neo-Darwinism, like survival of the fittest, which is the most difficult problem in Darwinism, because it's not scientific. It's circular. What is fit if it survives? What survives because it's fit? And it's not me necessarily saying this. You can Arthur Koestler, quite a long time ago, who is totally secular and open to all sorts of ideas. I mean, he wrote about revisiting Darwinism, neo-Darwinism, because it's crumbling.
Well, John, we got your views on Darwinism, but we didn't really get your thoughts on the creationism part
of
it.
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that all historical theories of science, whether evolution or Big Bang, are a form of art. They're not science at all because they in their nature, cannot stand the burden of proof. Now, I'm not arguing for or against the theory of evolution. I'm saying that it will forever remain a theory. It's impossible to be proved. And if you take the Big Bang, I just saw an obit in the New York Times of some major scientist who had lived his life demonstrating mathematically that the Big Bang theory was nonsense, and he was on the MIT faculty there. But what I think what we need to know is that all these battles back and forth are really political battles or philosophical battles or aesthetic battles. If you want to believe that the fittest survive, you want to believe what John Calvin said, that only a few are elected by the Lord, and that all the rest, regardless of how good their lives they lead are condemned. That's, of course, the theory of evolution when it's reduced to political terms. Whether evolution or creationism, wouldn't you agree, George, that every one of us who uses our mind has an interest in where this all came from?
Well, that's true. I agree with that.
And so to have a range of, colors on the palette strikes me as exactly what an artist would want. But to call any of these historical theories science is to not understand what science is.
Next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on with John Taylor Gatto. Hi there.
Hello. I have a question for John. First let me preface it by saying this. The statistic is that in inner city big public school systems, the non-graduation rate currently and for probably approximately the last 10 years has been at least 50% of the student enrollment never will graduate, even if they do attain ninth grade level. I was wondering, if when the schools were segregated back in the 60s before this integration came along, were their non-graduation rates the same, comparable, when they're segregated schools at that time? And if so, doesn't that say that our integrated school system has miserably failed them because their graduating level isn't any better?
Well, we'll agree that the schools have miserably failed them. I would have to dispute your unconscious connection of a graduation rate with any success in the development of either your mind or your character. But I want to say one further thing that ought to open up the debate for both of us. If you were in a business, a public business like schooling, and you wanted more money and more status, more prestige and more attention, would that come to you from success or failure? And I think it only takes a little reflection to realize that failure is a necessity for this huge institution, because only failure can lead to the statement that if we had more money, we would succeed better. And I've traced this back to the very beginning of institutional schooling, that calls for money as the answer to failure. Well, failure we're going to have with us, because nobody cares. You don't look at things that succeed. I mean, if it isn't broken, don't fix it, right? The real trouble with school reform, and I mean this quite literally, is that it would cost so little, so much less than we're currently spending on schools, that nobody involved in schooling could allow it to happen.
Scott from Charlotte, North Carolina, writes with a very interesting question for you. Homeschooling, how do they get scholarships and the like?
Oh, my. Okay. I'm gonna give you all out there, and I know there are millions of you, an assignment. You want your librarian to pick up a book from the interlibrary system called Trouble in Paradise by David and Mickey Colfax, C-O-L-F-A-X. They live in Northern California. They homeschooled their four sons on a hard clay mountaintop where they had to haul water for most of the kids' growing up time, and they lived in a car for the first year they were out there. And three of their four sons got full tuition scholarships to Harvard. The fourth son declined to ask for one because he was, at the age of 18, a nationally famous goat breeder, and he said, I don't have time to waste in college. And the whole account of how it's done, it's probably the best I've ever read, although I've read a bunch of good ones, but David Colfax, and Mickey, I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend you if you're listening, both of them, raised the four sons on what amounts to a poverty budget and three of the four full tuition scholarships at Harvard.
Fantastic. So there is hope.
There's a lot of hope. If you throw a bucket of cold water over your head and say, I'm going to think this through for myself, I'd say in the first couple of months, you'll suddenly begin to see what reality looks like, and in this case, reality in education, and you'll find that you have a lot of the resources you need, and you'll find that it's amazingly exciting to improvise the other resources.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Nori. Hello.
Hello.
I want to say what's up to the Springs. I'm glad that they're finally on over there. And we got to get Boulder on now, too, huh?
What?
Hello?
Hello. What are you saying? I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, you said that you're on in the Springs now, the Colorado Springs.
No, I was talking about some people who were calling from Colorado Springs. Yes, we're always out there. But go ahead with your question. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. My bad. Mr. Gatto, I just wanted to ask you two things. I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I just always kind of wanted to ask somebody. Darwin, as far as Darwin's theory is concerned, do you think that divine intervention kind of proves Darwin's theory false or no? As far as, like, say somebody did something stupid and they were about to die, but something happened so to save their life, like divine intervention, wouldn't that, like, disprove Darwin's theory?
Well, I think the difficulty in using that as an argument with other people are that it seems to come from your particular assessment of a situation, whether it was, I find nothing wrong with having a personal religion. It's just difficult to argue to your fellow citizens that school ought to be this way or that way, or we ought to teach this or that on that basis. And I'm not really competent to lecture an audience on what they ought to believe, although I have strong beliefs myself.
But you do believe, though, that Darwin's theories were motivated by the kinds of people he associated with.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. What he found was a miraculous way to turn theories of divine intervention that had been used as the stabilizing principle in governments for forever. He found a way to turn those into a scientific argument. There's a perfect identity between Darwin's argument and Calvin's argument. And really, it's fascinating, and the fact that Darwin was trained as an Anglican minister makes it even more fascinating.
John's book, by the way, the very new book he's got, is called The Underground History of American Education. He will knock $5 off that for you if you mention that you are a Coast to Coast AM listener. Also, he will throw in a free cassette of his speech on the scientific management of children. Couple ways for you to order this book and take advantage of the deal. And, of course, his website, those of you who are computer savvy, johntaylorgatto.com, and I'll spell that for you. It's just John, then Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, and then his last name, Gatto, Taylor Gatto, G-A-T-T-O, johntaylorgatto.com. Or you can fax him the order at 212-529-3555. That's 212-529-3555. And with that faxed order, of course, all the information that you normally put down when you fill out a credit card, that's the credit card number, your name, your address, your phone number, and the expiration date. You got to have all that in there, and then he'll be able to get you the book. But mention Coast to Coast AM, and you'll get the free cassette to the speech. If you like what he's saying now, you'll love that. And then you'll get $5 off the book, and every penny counts. I'll be back in a moment. We'll continue to take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM.
Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter online at www.coasttocoastam.com. Just click through the orange type to the secure server.
While I was away, and he was talking for I knew it, and as he grew, he'd say, I'm gonna be like you, Dad, you know I'm gonna be like you. And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, Dad, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, you know we'll have a good time then.
To talk with George Norrie, call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, they finally have that fire under control, that high rise that hit downtown Chicago, the LaSalle Bank Building. 5.5 hours they fought that thing. 34 people taken to the hospital, most of them firefighters who suffered smoke inhalation. Some of the injuries were serious. No deaths reported at this time. The streets around the Art Deco style building were closed. And again, that building houses the corporate headquarters of the LaSalle Bank. More than 300 firefighters battled that fire. Man, 22, by the way, of the 34 people were the firefighters involved in that fire. High rise, very old building, by the way, that building, very old. On our next Coast to Coast program, two guests, Paula Harris, Dr. Michael Sala, as we talk about exopolitics, the political implications of the extraterrestrial presence. So stick around for that. But when we come right back, we've got final phone calls with our guest, legendary teacher John Taylor Gatto. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with your phone calls. John, a couple people are sending me messages. They want to make sure they looked for the book, Trouble in Paradise. They couldn't find it, but they did find Hard Times in Paradise.
All right, Hard Times in Paradise.
Is that it?
You can write that off to an aging mind. But yes, Hard Times in Paradise, and you will absolutely love what you read.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's pick it up by going west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, George. How you doing?
Fine.
This is Bill calling from Tucson, Arizona.
Sure, Bill.
I wanted to tell you I really appreciate having a guest such as an intellectual, truthful, pure, logical man as Mr. Gatto. Mr. Gatto, I deeply appreciate your program tonight.
Thank you, Bill.
I can't help but recall what Galileo went through when he broke outside of the box of thinking and basically blasted the teachings of Copernicus, and they basically branded him as a heretic almost to the point of burning him to the stake. And I would say to those listening tonight, as a person who has done this, what you've been talking about, the hardest thing in the world is to sit down in a quiet moment and say to yourself that the only way that you can find absolute truth is to convince yourself that you must go back and unlearn all that you have been taught.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Bill.
You have to be willing to look at yourself in the mirror and deny that maybe you have been wrong about many things in your life. And I think that's the hardest thing for people to do, because they're afraid that they're going to rock the boat and maybe even disappoint themselves. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with that. And I would remind everybody listening that there has never in the history of the world been a major philosopher who didn't say, know thyself. Know yourself is the secret. Not know what you're supposed to know that the boss told you. Know yourself. I just heard before the show came on from a professional football critic that the great teams study the film to see what the individual players' tendencies are, and then what they try to do is change those tendencies, because they know the opposite team is studying the film to see what your habits are. Think of schools as a great conditioning mechanism to inculcate habits in you that are useful to the managers of business or society or whatever. And you need to be yourself and break those habits.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate your phone call and being on Coast to Coast. First time caller line. You're up. Hi there.
Yes. My name is Roger.
Hi, Roger.
Calling from in Ohio. I'm a truck driver. And I wanted to ask Mr. Gatto, boy, it sure is great to be on with y'all. I really been listening to y'all since Art Bell, and I think you're doing a great job, George.
Thank you.
But, Mr. Gatto, my son suffers from ADHD, and I was wondering the focus that he has trouble with. Is that a learned thing that the going through school is, you know, they teach you not to focus on, I guess, is what I'm getting at? Is
I think I understand, Roger. Of course, I only had 30 years experience with what's called ADHD, so I don't know everything, but in my experience, the ADHD that's identified by the school is very, very profitable to the school. And whether it exists or not in reality, or is just a set of learned habits, I would come down on it's a set of learned habits that can be unlearned, but not unlearned if you follow the instructions of the medical staff that associates itself with schooling. It's big business to dope kids up with Ritalin, for example. 93% of all the Ritalin used on planet Earth is used in the United States. So it's an instant fortune for drug companies. Similarly, ADHD is the heart of a jobs project. We don't find a record of it historically, either in this country or in any other country. It's an invention of recent times, and I think that a lot of parents have been driven sick by pseudo-medical advice.
Yeah, I always thought my tendencies when I was growing up, my mom kept me on a leash because when I was young, I would run off. I didn't care, you know, where I was, but she had to keep me where my five brothers would run off with me. But they wouldn't leave as long as I was there, but if I'd leave, so what it would be like is keeping them from being a leader.
Yes, yes. Incidentally, this is not apropos what you said, but I've found over the course of my life that truck drivers, especially long-distance truck drivers, are among the wisest people on earth. My closest friend is a long-distance truck driver who, when he was 52 years old, said, well, it's silly that I give all this money to somebody else. I'll just set up a long-distance trucking company. and now he's 70 next March, and I think he makes...
Whoop, still with us, John? Whoop, better get him back, Tommy. Better get him back. We got him flipped out there right at the end. We lost him just down there. So we'll get him right back on and get him to finish his questioning. I guess I should have brought the teacher an apple. Huh? Let's go to our wild card line while we get John back. I'll chat with you. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, George. It's Stuart calling. Has John disappeared?
Nope, we got him back.
Oh, great.
There you are, John. The wonders of broadcasting. We've
Hello,
got you.
Wonder. Hello, John.
Where are you from?
Oh, I'm on Maui in Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
Yes, wow.
Yeah, the Maui Times. He's a friend of mine, the publisher.
Wonderful. Well, the question I had, or actually I wonder if you'd be willing to give us a brief dissertation on your view of the influence that the Hegelian dialectic has had upon the educational, or if you like, schooling system in the United States, as well as our system of jurisprudence.
Oh, absolutely. But I must say that I want to separate Hegel and the dialectic. Aristotle, the dialectic, for those of you who are not up on philosophy, is a method and a style of thinking. And if you read Aristotle's Politics, you'll find that that wise man, a long time ago, said that people who can't think dialectically aren't really human beings. They're sort of incomplete things. Anyway, Hegel comes along a couple of hundred years ago at the University of Berlin in Prussia, and he gives the managerial classes, let me call them a planet Earth, a way to control history. How about that? And furthermore, people like J.P. Morgan go over there and study Hegel's system. Hegel says if you can provoke crisis, you know, you create a crisis. Let's say... I'm not suggesting this happen, but let's say that you make sure that two skyscrapers get knocked down by airplanes. Then under the guise of this provoked crisis, you can move history in radical directions. And your excuse is this crisis. We all know, I think, that Hitler did this. With the burning of the Reichstag back in the 1930s, and then that was an excuse to go after the inferior. There are an awful lot of people, and they're not nuts, who believe that the attack on Pearl Harbor was deliberately provoked by the Roosevelt administration. The way they did it was to cut off oil going to Japan in order to cause the Second World War, which was a way to get out of the Depression, and it certainly worked that way. So the Hegelian dialectic is a sinister thing, but let me tell you this, There's not a major university in this country that doesn't reserve the study of the Hegelian dialectic for its very, very finest students, the ones who are on the fast track. And I think that you and I and everyone better be aware of this so that we can judge historical events in our own life as to whether they're created crises or real crises.
John, you think exactly down the lines of all of us here at Coast to Coast. It's refreshing. If we were to change this system, this educational system, well, how would we start? What would we do?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because there are already in existence several asystematic systems that work so beautifully. I'll tell you about a few of them. We've already talked about one of them that's probably too big and sprawling to get a fix on, called homeschooling. But let me talk of two very much narrower undertakings, one by the Old Order Amish, who exist in a few states like central Pennsylvania and Wisconsin with their own kids. I spoke at an Amish convention 5 or 6 years ago, and one Amish said to me, we could build a rocket to the moon if we didn't think it was damn nonsense to do that. He said, we can do anything, and they can. It's fascinating. Johns Hopkins University, which is no slouch where universities go, has studied the Amish for about 30 years, and it says they are the wealthiest coherent group in the United States. And their biggest problem is that they already have, by their own lights, perfect lives, and so what are they going to do with all this money they make? It gets in the way. So I've mentioned the Amish and the fact that they have virtually no divorce, no drug use, that every Amish kid is raised to have an independent livelihood. Think about that for a moment, because that really is the key. The United States dazzled the world right up to the Civil War because we raised every kid to have an independent livelihood. Now, that didn't mean that 20 or 30 of them didn't throw together and have an enterprise going, but people who had to work for a living, like the truck driver who just caught it, were trained to put some money aside and think about having an independent living when they assembled a small stake. The criticism I've gotten from some people when I say that is, well, the Amish are held together by this powerful religious glue, and that's true. So now let me offer you a totally non-religious group in the northwest corner of Spain called the Mondragon Cooperative. Let me spell that. Mondragon. They're almost exactly the size of the Amish in the United States, except they're non-religious, actively non-religious. They have a system among their own children of raising every kid to have an independent livelihood, and through all the 20th century, when Europe was in depression or recession, the economy in this area of Spain was always booming. I went there last year, and it's just dazzling. They don't raise anybody to be an employee. Now, would that mean the end of giant corporations? Certainly, as we know it, it would mean the end of that. It's a different kind of economy, but it's quite prosperous.
All right, let's go to our East of the Rockies. Thank you, John, for that. East of the Rockies, go ahead. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, this is Kathy in Roswell, Georgia.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, John and George. Yeah,
hi,
I just wanted to say that when my kids were in school, they had a difficult time just making attendance, and most of the time they didn't have very good attendance. And people were very upset with me that, don't you want them to get an education? But the school seemed to want them to love conformity, and I wanted them to love to learn, and they were destroying their love, their natural, basic love of learning. And I said, if they love to learn, they will get an education, you know? And I don't leave it to the public schools to educate them. And they've done very well. But the thing is, if they could, when the schools make learning miserable and tedious and a negative experience, you don't have to dumb people down. They'll dumb themselves down.
That's right. That's what John Calvin said. They'll police themselves.
Yeah.
And by dumbing themselves down, by making themselves ignorant and crude and ill-mannered, all manner of things. Schools can't provide an education, period. Schools can school. Now, schooling is, in a limited sense, useful in many cases. You want to take a rifle apart and put it back together blindfolded. You want to be well-schooled. But in order to develop good judgment and personal goals and philosophies and all the important things in a life, you have to have an education. And the more you're schooled, the less you're able to do that. I think you did the right thing. I mean, compulsory attendance is itself a horror. That should make anyone suspicious that the principle of independent access is broken by the laws of schooling, so that a kid can't discover apprenticeships for himself or herself, you know, and follow their own star. If you read the obituaries, and my goodness, I urge all of you to read the obituaries in some major newspaper and in magazines, they'll show you the arc of successful lives. And over again, you'll see that the principles that you think, well, that you've been taught, are the right principles, were violated by everybody who's successful.
Well, like the bell in a school that ends the class, John, we're out of time. I want to thank you for a very enlightening educational night.
Oh, I had a lot of fun doing this. And people mention Coast to Coast. And we'll cut you the break on the book, and we'll give you the free cassette. But mention Coast to Coast, or we can't do it.
Great. Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Bye now.
His website linked up with his name right there on coasttocoastam.com. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie back in the City of Angels. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, everyone, be safe.